Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to introduce my guest co-host, again, Dr. Bob Gwaither. Welcome, Bob.
Thanks, Adam.
You know, on our show today, Bob, we are going to be talking with Cy Sternberg, director of Express Scripts and a former CEO of New York Life Insurance Company, about a retired CEO's views on healthcare. You know, this is a perspective we don't hear, which is really a business perspective. It's an important one, given particularly how many Americans have health insurance.
And definitely it's a part of the puzzle to work out, because we've got doctors, hospitals, the insurance companies, and everybody's trying to work together.
But, you know, first, we've got some really interesting research that matters. We're going to be talking about hospital routines, how they can actually make patients sicker sometimes. We're going to be talking about how a lot of adults, as they get older, are burdened by the system.
Yeah, and we put them in the hospital, don't let them eat. We put them in rooms where there's noises and people walking in and out all night, and they don't get their normal rest, and it makes it difficult because those are not healthy.
We're going to talk about calcium stones. And finally, we're going to talk about prescription opiate abuse. First, though, let's talk about really this hospital routines that you just mentioned. This was actually a paper that was in the journal, the British Medical Journal, Quality and Safety, really saying that, you know, we're bringing people into the hospital to get them well, but we're not really allowing them to get sleep and really good nutrition.
So it's common for somebody to present to an emergency room, have a bevy of people there, be there for a couple of days before they actually get a room, and have to endure the noise, the commotion, and everything that goes on down there. Maybe they get fed some food, but maybe they're having a study done that doesn't allow that, and so they get thrown off their normal routines.
Yeah, we've seen so many patients, Bob, you and I, when we're in the emergency room, and it could be 11 o'clock at night, and they say, is it possible I could get something to eat? You know, that seems like a common – and or we send them up to the room, and we put in orders for food, but, you know, it could be 11 o'clock at night, and the food may not come for a couple hours. That's the bad side. I do think we've done better at trying to get better nutrition in some of the food that's served in the hospitals. There's good efforts, I think, or at least underway.
And they point out in this article that it's a myth that you have to have 8 hours of no eating before a surgical procedure, because they say you can give somebody high carbohydrate drinks up to 2 hours before a surgery and not run the work of the risk of having it aspirated into their lungs.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things we could probably do is this sleep issue, because I know that as a doctor, you know, I'm going to start rounding 6:30 in the morning. Well, I may want my lab work to be ready when I start my round, so they may come in at 4 in the morning to do blood work. I remember my father of blessed memory once said when they came in to weigh him at 4 in the morning, he said, get out.
He had some chutzpah.
He just realized that that was not for his benefit. It was for someone else's. Complicated issue. I think patients could advocate and help us make this better.
I think they can too.
What about this next research that matters, Bob, about 4 in 10 adults having some real problems kind of navigating the healthcare system?
Well, it's published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine this month. And essentially what they did was go out and ask people, do you want to be an active participant in your healthcare decisions? And most people say, yes, they do. And other family members involved too, yes, they do. But when they really come down to it, people 65 and older tend to be more passive in that. And what happens is we wind up sending them off to this specialist, that specialist, this set of tests, and it's kind of a confusing thing. And so there needs to be a coordinator of care to help them understand what the process is going to be and where they are in it as they work their way through it. That tends to be the primary care provider. And in many cases, people don't have one.
Well, in addition, this is an expensive proposition too, because we need more time and that has a cost. We need more coordination. That has a cost. And I think, though, that's what we have to do. This is the way it's going to work. I think our guest, Cy Sternberg, will probably have some views on this, because it may improve quality, may improve outcomes, but it's not going to reduce cost. What about our very next research that matters, Bob, about calcium supplements and kidney stones? You've treated, I'm sure, thousands of patients with calcium. You've probably seen hundreds of patients with kidney stones. This ever come up?
Oh, yeah, it does. Because the easy thing to do is say to somebody, well, go down to your local pharmacy or one of these other specialty shops and pick yourselves up some calcium supplements to take. And some people have done some research at Dr. Matthew Sorensen, assistant professor of urology at the University of Washington in Seattle. And he determined that, well, first of all, it's probably important to say that most kidney stones have calcium in them. What Dr. Sorensen and his colleagues showed that is if you give people calcium supplement, the incidence of their kidney stones goes up if it's taken as supplements. But ironically, if you give it to them as part of normal diet, like, say, meat, the incidence of kidney stones goes down.
So, and it is complicated, but I think a lot of patients who are taking calcium are taking it for bone strength. And yet they may also develop kidney stones. And we see elevated calcium levels sometimes in the bloodstream, which can also have kidney stones. So I think it's this paradoxic element here that when you have elevated calcium or in your bloodstream or you have kidney stones, the doctor needs to think about, are you on a calcium supplement? And perhaps even stopping that calcium supplement if they start to see your blood calcium go up. That's the dilemma here.
And we need to recognize that this is written by urologists, and kidney stones are what they deal with. There's a lot of patients that take supplements that don't ever have a kidney stone.
That's right. And we wouldn't want anyone to stop their calcium supplement for good reasons that they're taking it because they're worried about kidney stones. That would be something you'd definitely want to talk with your doctor about, particularly your primary care doctor. What about our very last research that matters, Bob?
Well, this study is of prescription painkillers, what's happening to abuse rates and what's happening to people generally.
And right. and you, and we should let our listeners know if they don't, Dr. Gwaithir has been one of the leaders around the state and nationally for a long time at thinking about this issue and a drug abuse way before it really escalated into a national problem.
Right. This study is actually put together by a Dr. Beth Hahn, who works at the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And essentially, they polled a whole lot of people. They went back and did record reviews on 472,000 adults who participated in annual surveys and found that in the last few years, we've had some reduction in the number of people who are abusing opiates.
That's good.
That's good. And that's defined as using them for purposes other than intended. So not to kill pain, but maybe to get high and go to a party. On the other hand, the ones that continue to do it are using more pills.
That's not good.
So the number of patients has gone down, the number of pills going up, and that's the dilemma here.
And here's what I think is happening. I saw this, and I saw, oh, good news, bad news. But what I think is that doctors and society, we're doing better at really preventing the abuses at the level that people maybe have some of these really bad outcomes, but we're not really addressing the root cause, which is the addiction. And so therefore, those that are kind of there are perhaps having a harder time. So I think we've got to double down not just on stopping the abuse, but helping those that are addicted.
And these people point out 80% of narcotics abusers fail to get treatment for addiction. And I'll say that the same 80% number is also the people referred for addiction treatment by their criminal justice system is 80%. Only 20% come from others like healthcare providers.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters, Bob. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Cy Sternberg, director of Express Scripts and former CEO of New York Life Insurance Company, about a retired CEO's views on healthcare. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwaithir. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwaithir. Today on Conversations, Bob, we're talking with Cy Sternberg, director of Express Scripts and former CEO of New York Life Insurance, about a retired CEO's views on healthcare. Welcome to Your Health, Cy.
Welcome, Mr. Sternberg, and thank you for being with us today.
You know, it's really good to have you here. And I think Bob and I are really excited to really have someone who has been in the business community from such a large perspective talking to Your Health listeners. Tell us a little bit, Sai, about your path to where you are now. How did you get involved and interested in healthcare?
Well, I'd have to say part of it was by chance and not pre-planning. I graduated City College of New York in the mid-60s with a degree in electrical engineering, and my first job was at Raytheon Missile Systems Division. And for the first 2 or 3 years, I did traditional engineering, but I started to migrate from hardware engineering to information systems and software about 3 years after I joined Raytheon. I was involved in the development of their automated drafting system, and I fell in love with systems, computer systems. And by the time I left Raytheon, I was in charge of their first management information systems department. After that tenure there at Raytheon, I was hired by a consulting firm that won a contract with Mass Mutual Life Insurance Company to fully automate their operations, tying all the agencies of the Mass Mutual to the home office and everything from sales illustrations to premiums to commissions and the like. And I worked for the consulting firm for about a year, and then I was hired away by the insurance company. So I started to work as a full-time officer of the Mass Mutual Life Insurance Company. I developed systems for their life insurance business. I developed systems for their health insurance business at the end of that tenure. And before I left Mass Mutual, I was one of three members of their office of the chairman, and I was doing general management. The way that during the course of working in information systems, because they liked my management talent, the CEO asked me if I wanted to take over the health insurance business of Mass Mutual. I had told him that, you know, I knew a lot about systems, but I didn't know anything about sales. I didn't know anything about actuarial science. So he said, well, don't worry, you'll learn it. What I didn't know is that they were at a point where they were thinking of potentially closing their health insurance business. So they say, why not take a shot and see what Sternberg could do? So I took over the health insurance business. That was a very important juncture in my life. And I was successful. We turned it around, and as long as I was there, we were making money. We were profitable in the health insurance business. I then left to join New York Life Insurance Company, heading their health insurance business. It's about twice the size of the Mass Mutual business. And then I rose up the ranks at New York Life to ultimately become president of the company and then subsequently CEO of the company. I became CEO of New York Life on April Fool's Day of 1997, and I remained as both CEO and chairman until 2008, 11 years, and I stayed an additional year as chairman.
Wow, that's a remarkable story.
It's interesting.
So that's the story.
It's interesting that April Fool's Day is when you took it on and you're on our radio show on Halloween, so what's that say?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Right. I'm curious about the player that insurance is in our industry. If you look at all the national, international health systems, Americans are upwards of twice as expensive as anybody else in the country, and our outcomes aren't nearly as good, and it's really a problem, and it's a struggle from lots of parts of the industry. I mean, physicians, hospitals, insurance companies are big players. How do you think this is going to work out? Can you see any?
Well, first of all, let me say something, and with some trepidation, because I know I'm talking to two docs. The insurance industry is not responsible for the level of prices. Okay, they are not. I mean, if you look at a premium dollar that is collected by an insurance company, in spite of what you might have heard from the president, 98 cents out of every dollar on large insurance plans covers claims. Either they're paying a hospital bill or a physician bill or a test or whatever. The reason why we have such a relatively expensive system is because our delivery system is expensive. Our docs are paid much more than the docs are being paid in Sweden. The hospitals collect more money and have much larger operations and much more sophisticated operations than many of the national hospitals in the world. I'm not suggesting we change that. What I like, as a matter of fact, about our healthcare delivery system is we have an outstanding healthcare delivery system. But the expense is a function of the delivery system, not the insurance company.
How do you see one of the criticisms of the U.S. system as compared to, let's say, the Canadian system or others is the administrative expense? And I would imagine with a lot of the changes that have actually occurred, presumably to try to increase quality in the last number of years of care, it has also dramatically, in our clinic, increased our administrative expenses. That seems to be a real issue. What are your thoughts on that from up high?
You might have seen a small increase in administrative expenses, but in terms of what we see as the overall driver of cost, other than what we'll have a chance to talk about this later, pharmaceuticals, which is a significant component, we still are dealing with an expensive hospital system and medical system. The medical system does have an administrative layer, and doctors would be particularly sensitive to it because it is more administration than you've seen for all the reasons you mentioned. But the reality of the situation is we have a very, very high-quality system, and it's expensive. And unless somebody's going to bite the bullet and say we ought to, you know, have a 15% reduction in what docs are getting paid, which I don't support, by the way, that's what you're paying for. It's not administrative. I mean, it's administrative is still a relatively small component of the overall cost.
We believe there's also an access problem in the country because there seems to be a lot of people who just don't go to the doctor because they can't afford it. And when they do get sick, they wind up in an emergency room, which is a bad place for cost reduction.
You're right. I mean, there's no question about it. And as you know, there are multiple programs at work to try to get individuals into urgent care centers and the like to at least make it a much more available than a private practice. But you're right, especially in the poorer neighborhoods, you see the emergency room as the family physician, and particularly in urban settings.
Well, if you were to take a step back, you know, health insurance, from what I understand, clearly, you know, has not been around as a, you know, 500-year phenomenon in the United States, even much more than 100 years. It's a post-World War II. Tell us how you understood, you know, health insurance as a relatively modern issue and how important that is, obviously, for not only your business, but how it's evolved.
Well, you know, first of all, let me point out an important role that health insurance plays. You right now, if you take a look at a hospital, and I'm sure the same thing applies in Carolina as it does at New York Presbyterian Hospital, we have three kinds of patients. We have Medicare patients, the elderly, we have Medicaid, the indigent, and we have private payers who come through insurance companies, largely. Medicare does not carry its full cost. Medicaid does not carry its full cost. If it were not for the private payer system, the system largely supported through the insurance company and the rates negotiated by the insurance company, if it were not for philanthropy, the major tertiary care centers in the United States would not be able to survive. Simple as that. Would not be able to survive. Because the government is not paying their fair share of the cost of delivering medical care in those hospitals.
Well, I know we're going to...
That's a fact. So I wanted to put that up front. You know, we could talk about all the ills and problems of the insurance industry, but the insurance industry cost-effectively supports employer groups, supports medical delivery systems, HMOs, and individuals and self insurance to it, and aggregates all of this and provides facility for all of this, such that it works. And while Medicare might claim to be more efficient, they're only more efficient because they're paying less, and they're not paying sufficiently to support the healthcare system in most of the tertiary care hospitals.
Yeah, Bob and I haven't met too many doctors who say they'd rather have Medicare reimbursement than private health insurance. But we're going to need to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to maybe pick up on this conversation about cost of care and how you, as a former CEO, see ways that are currently underway to reduce costs and what are the benefits and perhaps some drawbacks to that. But we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Cy Sternberg, director of Express Scripts and former CEO of New York Life Insurance Company, about a retired CEO's views on healthcare. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwaither. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwaither. We've been talking with Cy Sternberg, director of Express Scripts and former CEO of New York Life Insurance, about a retired CEO's view on healthcare. And Bob, I think you had something you wanted to ask about Affordable Care Act.
So we've been talking already about the health insurance industry, that's for sure. This Affordable Care Act that got passed a couple of years ago has slowly but surely been implemented with almost everything that's out there now. How do you see the future of that in the midst of all the other chaotic things in the health insurance industry?
Well, you know, it isn't working out quite the way it was assumed to work out when it was drafted, because the concept was that we are going to bring all the people into the plan, and we're going to bring sick people into the plan, many uninsured, and somehow this is going to be paid for by younger people who will be mandated to buy health insurance. And if they don't buy health insurance, we'll impose a penalty on them. Well, in fact, the bill that was passed does not really have a significant penalty imposed, and therefore the younger population is opting out. This, by the way, is absolutely consistent with the theory of insurance. People buy insurance when they believe they're buying a coverage which is consistent with the premium they're paying. If, in fact, the elderly people who have more claims are being subsidized by younger people who have fewer claims, the younger people are going to opt out and are not going to buy in. And that's what's happening. We have a lopsided employee population or individual population within the Affordable Care Act that is older than we had hoped for and is sicker than we had hoped for, has higher morbidity, and until such time as we adjust pricing to be consistent with implicit risk, you're going to wind up with this imbalance, which will have to be paid for by tax dollars.
Well, you know, you are also the founding and a director of Express Scripts, which you're tell us a little bit about that, and I know that the reduction of cost as it relates to the pharmaceutical industry is also a huge concern. Tell us a little bit about Express Scripts and then how the cost issue is playing out in that sort of industry.
Okay, well, Express Scripts is an intermediary. We act between the pharmaceutical manufacturer, the drug manufacturer, and those groups that are buying pharmaceutical coverage, drug coverage, for their members, either members of HMOs or employees of corporations who are going to Express Scripts for healthcare coverage, and Express Scripts basically negotiate pricing, which is substantially discounted because Express Scripts is buying at huge volume. Express Scripts is the the largest pharmaceutical benefit manager in the country. And another company that it competes with is CVS, Caremark, again, responsible, acting as an intermediary between the drug manufacturer and the individual who's buying the coverage. The other role we play, other than kind of mass marketing or mass buying, is in a new world, and that's the world of specialty drugs. As you very well know, there are certain drugs that are out there that are for very limited purposes. Cancer treatment, for example, the most recent discussion you may have seen in newspapers is hepatitis C. There's a regimen that was created by a pharmaceutical company to, in fact, treat hepatitis C. However, it had a price tag of $85,000 for the range of treatment. Express Square, and there are three, say, companies having a Hep C protocol. Well, Express Scripts went to one of them and said, we will give you all of our business if we get a significant discount for our members. And at the end of the day, and I don't know the exact number, but let's assume they negotiated something in the $50,000 range, cutting the cost by $30,000 because of the leverage that was exercised by Express Scripts on the manufacturers of these drugs, basically saying it's an all-or-nothing game. You're not going to get anything from us if you don't reduce the price. That kind of intermediary is playing an extraordinarily important role. And by the way, I should tell you, our competitors in the pharmacy benefit management space then went back to the other manufacturers and got similar discounts, and as a result, you're winding up bringing the cost of those specific drugs for hepatitis C down to a much more affordable level, although still very high.
So I understand that your company has clients in Canada as well as the United States, and I'm curious about what their healthcare laws and legislation will allow in terms of pricing, say, a drug like the one for hepatitis B.
I'm sorry to say that as a board member of Express Scripts, I have not focused on that, so I really can't give you an answer to that question. I wish I had the answer, but I'm not sure exactly what's going on in the Canadian space on that.
You know, one of the things that you also do is you also serve on other boards, and I know one of them is New York Presbyterian Hospital. How do you see the management of a huge hospital like that or like ones that Bob and I are in versus the management of, let's say, New York Life? What are the things that are similar or different for you?
Well, it's interesting. At the end of the day, both a hospital and a company like New York Life collects the amount of revenue, and at the end of the day, they have to, in fact, manage their overall costs and expenses within the revenue they're collecting. It's very simpler because it's actually, in New York Life's case, we're a mutual company, so we don't care about share price, et cetera. We basically are a mutual company where our expenses our revenues cover our expenses. And as you know, New York Presbyterian Hospital is a nonprofit hospital. So yes, we accumulate capital for a rainy day in both of the cases. But at the end of the day, we cannot be successful if we don't manage our expenses within the overall revenue umbrella. In the case of Presbyterian, it also, again, has a philanthropic component. So that's what's common about it. But what is also common is that you've got to have a good leadership group looking not just to be successful in today's world, but you have to look out to where the world is moving so that your enterprise is successful going forward.
So that actually, excuse me.
We are starting to, and I know many other hospitals are enlarging their system. So you not only have the tertiary care center, but you have a whole ring of community hospitals that in fact act as a feeder group to the tertiary care center. And I'm on one of the committees of New York Presbyterian. There's a systems committee, and they're not talking about computer systems. They're talking about hospital systems with community hospitals and tertiary care centers, and a lot of time and money is being invested in that area.
So we're titling this the current talk you're giving on this show, a retired CEO's views on healthcare. So how would you like to see insurance, pharmaceuticals, and patient care evolve as times go on?
Well, you know, I don't want to put a pessimistic spin on this. I am very concerned about the current state, that we have an Affordable Care Act, which is going to put more and more pressure on our insurance industry. And if our, at some point, if the insurance industry cannot be a profitable venture, you're not going to wind up with companies wanting to move forward in that space. And that's very vital. I am concerned clearly about the escalation, of course, you know, because you're absolutely right. You know, the cost of health care is still not under control. And at some point, everybody throws up their hands and the government taking over as being the solution becomes a very scary option. I hope that we will gain some rationality in this area. I'm a firm believer that you cannot depend upon the insurance companies to balance the cost. If you have, as you have in the Affordable Care Act, high-risk people going into insurance pools, that is, in fact, a prescription for disaster. I would have been much more pleased to see the high-risk people. If the American people want to insure the 30 million uninsurable, the best way to have done that was to put them in a high-risk pool and announce to the United States, just how this costs money, and here's what the increase in taxes is going to be to pay for it. Don't try to fool anybody by burying it into an insurance premium. It should be an insurance premium. It's an added cost, and the American public then has a very important decision to make. Do they want to subsidize and support high-risk people who maybe couldn't buy insurance because of their healthcare situation? That's the way I would do it. That's a very honest approach to give with the American public.
Well,
instead, we're going to be insidiously paying for this by virtue of the fact of increased premiums to all the people who are insured. And the people who aren't insured are not paying their fair share because they're staying out of the system. Not a good, stable situation. So I hate to end on a negative note, but I am not optimistic unless we do something about the Affordable Care Act.
Well, you know, Mr. Sternberg, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. It's a pleasure to hear your honesty. I don't think in terms of fooling, anyone's going to be fooling in terms of believing something that you don't believe, and we appreciate you sharing your belief. I think it'll stimulate conversations among listeners, and perhaps at some point in time we can have you back on the show, because I don't think the issue is going away in the next year or two.
Thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwaither.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Bob and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And if you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question today, about someone who's concerned about remembering names.
For the past few months, I have had a difficult time recalling names of people, some of whom I have known for years. If I see them, I feel pressured to remember their names, but usually do not succeed right away. However, I usually remember the names about 15 minutes later. Does this mean I'm getting Alzheimer's disease?
Well, let me say that that's a really common problem with people as they age. And there's something called benign forgetfulness of aging, and that's what that category falls into, or that example falls into.
And if that were a litmus test for Alzheimer's, we'd probably have 100 times more Alzheimer's in the United States, because that is common.
The difference is that when somebody has Alzheimer's disease or when it's progressing, they don't even remember that they forgot your name. And 15 minutes later, that would be completely out of their mind. And so the fact that the person remembers later on sort of makes it unlikely to be Alzheimer's disease. And it's more the much more common cognitive aging.
And I think one of the questions really is, because this does happen a lot, but it is also socially embarrassing when you don't remember someone's name. I was out to eat last night, and someone who I know I should know, who couldn't remember their name. And, you know, I just simply said, hey, good to see you again, Adam Goldstein. And, you know, they said, yeah, I know you, Adam. I said, fine. And, you know, and we talked. But at least I'm throwing out there, you know, rather than saying, I don't really remember your name exactly. Yeah. But you could say that, too. And then there's tricks one does to try to remember someone's name, right? I don't know how you do that, Bob. And, you know, I'm in the clinic. I'm always trying to say their name three or four times while they're there with me so I can really try to remember it.
Or you think of something that's coincident with their name, and that's how you remember it. So maybe somebody with a bushy beard is Harry, and that's how you remember that's Harry, you know?
Yeah. Bob, I just know your name. Daniel, what's our very next house call?
I'm a 58-year-old man. Lately, when I walk on my treadmill in the morning, I get a pain in my left shoulder that goes away when I stop walking. Is this something to worry about?
Well, I'm worried. A short answer. Yeah, I mean, well, doctors, we want to worry for you in part, and you're worried because you wrote this question to us, and you're getting some pain when you're on a treadmill. Statistically, it's not likely to be heart problems, but you're at the age in which the number one killer is heart problems. So I would be worried. What about you, Bob?
Well, there's this word called angina, which means cardiac-oriented pain. And while lots of pain that's in the center of the chest is not due to the heart, we also know that an occasional person can have a pain in their left shoulder, their left elbow, and that can be their manifestation of angina.
That's your warning sign.
So I think this needs to be checked out. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a red herring, but I wouldn't let it go.
Right. Sometimes you can get a trigger point in your shoulder that when you're exercising gets irritated, but you know what? That's not going to kill you.
Right. Exactly right.
And we don't want this to harm you. So we encourage you to make an appointment with your primary care doctor, cardiology, get it investigated, get a formal treadmill while you're being evaluated while you're on that exercise. Daniel, what's our very next house call?
Last month, I had some scratch testing done on my back by an allergist. I had positive reactions to peanuts and ragweed pollen, both of which seem to bother me if I am exposed to them. But I also had a positive test for oak tree pollen. My backyard has several oak trees in it, which have never bothered me. How can this be?
Well, that's a really good question. And first off, we're in a season, the fall allergies, but of course, some people have spring allergies, some people have winter allergies, summer allergies, some people have allergies around the year. And two of the more common things are peanuts and ragweed pollen. So you have some significant allergies there. And it wouldn't be surprised on your scratch test. That's that test that literally they put little things on you to see what you react to, that you probably react to a number of things.
And the truth is that you can put this scratch on somebody with just a little glycerin, and it can – some people will have a flare to some of those and not other ones. So you can't – hang your hat on that. And the most important thing is clinically what's the thing that bothers you. And you certainly should avoid peanuts and ragweed if you possibly can, though that's tough to avoid. But oak pollen is probably not a problem for you. It's probably a false positive test.
Or possibly maybe it's a false positive identification of the tree. Maybe it's not an oak pollen tree. But we'll see.
Yeah.
Take a picture. Send it to us. What's our very last house call, Daniel?
Last month, I started having a high-pitched ringing in both of my ears. It is always there, though it can get louder or softer during the day. I'm able to sleep and carry on conversations just fine. My neighbor says he has the same thing and it keeps him awake. Is there anything I can do to make it go away?
Well, what you're describing is probably what we call tinnitus.
Or tinnitus.
Some people say tinnitus. And that is exactly that. It's ringing in the ears. And it can be in one ear, can be in both ears, and it does tend to get louder and softer. Some of that depends on what is going on around you, because if you're in the middle of a busy intersection with a lot of traffic, you don't tend to notice it.
You know, Bob, I had a patient not too long ago that had this, but they also had a little bit of a decreased hearing. And as I arranged them to get formal hearing tests, turns out they had significant hearing loss. You see that sometimes?
Yeah, you do. And I think that's more coincidental than cause and effect. But I think it's worth getting it checked out if you got a question. I don't know a treatment that works very well for it. I think people have tried various things, but there's certainly no standard.
Yeah, a lot of times they try to do this stimulus control where you just kind of can get a background noise and you kind of get used to it. But the problem is that for some people that doesn't work, and some of these treatments are actually expensive, and very few doctors actually do them or know about them. So
A lot of people might tell your friend who's bothered because he can't sleep to get himself some nice, soft music, maybe some classical music to play while he's sleeping, and a lot of people can deal with it that way.
Yeah, I like that, classical music. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank you all for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can send your questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search for our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, my guest, great co-host always, and our guest today, Mr. Cy Sternberg. We hope you join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll look forward to talking with you next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.